Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Barack Obama live from sub-Saharan Africa. Barack Obama on live television from a very excited nation of Ghana later today. His reception in Africa is likely to be warmer than it was in Russia earlier this week, with less disagreement than in Italy at the G8 summit. And he won't have to kiss any rings like he will be doing at the Vatican today when he meets with Pope Benedict. In fact, a trip to Africa might just have some healing powers, like a salve.
I think it's going to be a real salve for the president. I think he's going to need it by the end of the week.
Marcus Mabry, editor and longtime Africa reporter from the New York Times, you said on this program, there's the clip right there, that President Obama was going to need a warm homecoming trip like Africa after this week. Pretty good call, I'd say.
Well, thanks very much, John. As it turns out, he's gotten slings and arrows both abroad and here at home while he's not even been here.
So this will be a relief. Stay with us, Marcus. We're going to talk details of this presidential trip in just a moment. Live television? Try live radio. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, July 10th. I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to be talking a lot about Africa this hour, including learning about a militant group related to Al-Qaeda that has carried out a slew of attacks in northern Africa in recent weeks. And Sacha Baron Cohen pushes the line between offensive and funny, and we help him here. The movie Bruno opens today. Are there lines in Sacha Baron Cohen's work? I don't think so. Those stories coming up, but we have all you need to know this morning in the headlines. There are reports out now that General Motors has officially emerged from bankruptcy protection. The Associated Press is citing a person briefed on the matter. More details are expected at a news conference about an hour from now. President Obama and other world leaders at the G8 summit in Italy have announced a major agricultural initiative worth $15 billion. It's designed to help farmers increase food production in developing countries. It comes after the G8 met with some African leaders. Illinois Senator Roland Burris has told Democratic leaders that he won't seek a full term in the Senate in 2010. He was appointed to the seat that former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is accused of selling. New information about the cyber attacks on government websites in South Korea and the U.S. South Korean intelligence officials say they were launched from 16 different countries, including the United States, China, and Japan. Some mosques are reported to have opened in a regional capital in northwest China, despite an earlier order for them to close in the wake of violence between Muslim Uyghurs and Han Chinese. Not clear if there was a change of policy or if the mosques opened because crowds had gathered outside. The Washington Post is reporting this morning that insurance giant AIG plans to pay millions of dollars in bonuses for several dozen executives. They've asked the government's blessing on the matter. We will see. NASA's going to give the much-delayed Endeavour launch another try tomorrow. The agency has a short window to get the shuttle off the ground. The Dow was pretty much flat yesterday, along with the S&P and the NASDAQ. The S&P begins trading at 883 this morning. The NASDAQ begins at 1753, and the Dow begins at 8183. We're investigating the state of the American mall in this economy. Retail sales were way down yesterday. You may notice it in your mall. Tell us what you're seeing. Your story is at 8778-MY-TAKE. The Mall of America is changing. Tell us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. There's plenty going on for the president today, but when Air Force One touches down in Accra, Ghana, it will be just after sunset, and they're on the tarmac will be veteran West Africa correspondent for our partners, the BBC, Will Ross, who now covers East Africa but has been deployed to Accra for this historic arrival of the president. Will Ross, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Describe the level of anticipation in Ghana. It is not unprecedented for a president to visit. In fact, George W. Bush was just there a year ago. But what's it like on the ground today?
Well, there's a lot of anticipation. People are very excited about the imminent arrival of President Barack Obama. I was actually here a year ago, and it was certainly a very different feeling there, not as much enthusiasm for George Bush's visit. Have to be said, though, 10 years ago, Bill Clinton was here, and enormous crowds greeted him on the streets. Sadly, it looks as though this particular trip by President Obama, it's going to be about 24 hours, and there won't be much of an opportunity for the Ghanaian people, ordinary Ghanaian, to get a glimpse of him. And, they'll probably end up, most of them, watching it on television stations because it's a pretty tight schedule. And partly because of the rainy season and partly because of security concerns, there aren't going to be a great deal of opportunities for people to see him. Having said that, people are excited and very proud that he's chosen Ghana as the country to visit to send out his message to Africa.
So some definite rainy season rain on the parade there for Barack Obama. Why are the security concerns so much higher for this president than, say, Bill Clinton or George W. Bush?
Well, I think it's similar security concerns this time as there were for President George Bush when he was here. But remember that 10 years ago when Bill Clinton came, that was pre-9/11, and I think just with a general feeling that things were a little safer. Now the security is a bit tighter, and also it's a short visit. This is only 24 hours, and he's also arriving quite late at night, so that's not going to be easy for Ghanaians to get out and welcome him. Getting home is actually quite difficult from the airport. There's also a lot of restrictions on where people can go, and because of the rain, it's actually going to be held in a conference center, the main address that Barack Obama is going to give. And that is invitees only. So as I say, really, it's going to be a question of most Ghanaians are proud that he's coming, a bit upset and concerned that they're not going to have a chance to really interact with him or perhaps even see him. The best they'll get is probably a fleeting glance of a car going past.
And live television there will be the best way people can witness President Obama's visit to Accra in Ghana. Will Ross, East Africa correspondent for the BBC, but a veteran West Africa reporter, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Continuing now with our discussion of President Obama's visit to Africa, and really issues related to Africa began early this morning when the president attended a breakfast, which included some leaders from Africa and also officials from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and an agricultural agreement was announced this morning worth apparently $15 billion. Joining us to talk about this, continuing with us anyway, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our part in the New York Times and longtime Africa reporter himself. You covered Johannesburg in the 90s, correct?
I was based in Joburg and covered all of sub-Saharan Africa.
Also with us this morning is Owen Kibenge, who is a journalist from Uganda who moved to New York last August and is joining us here in the studio. Owen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for hosting me.
To both of you, and I'll begin with you, Marcus, there were some hard issues on the table this morning for President Obama. As smushy as this story is about Obama going home and welcome home and all the posters and the kind of atmospherics, there are some very hard issues related to the troubled global economy that the president is dealing with even this morning.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he's there at the G8 summit in Italy, and these are usually the billed as the most important, largest, most powerful economies in the world, and they're all very hobbled right now, and they're making lots of promises, the newest promise being a $15 billion aid package that's meant to, for once, help Africa, not by giving it, you know, commodities, which often it does. Agricultural aid is often just shipping up excess stuff from the Western countries. Right. That actually doesn't help Africa to develop.
And they get the message in Africa. They're not clueless about this. They sort of see the sloppy seconds that are coming from the West. Yeah.
And this money is meant to help Africa to actually develop agricultural capacity, which, you know, it's the old teach a man to fish versus giving him a fish. So,
Owen Kibenge, what are you thinking in terms of the issues for Barack Obama as he lands in Ghana, as opposed to all the sort of homecoming atmospherics?
First of all, my take on this trip is that he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, for starters. Because, one, he should have gone to Nairobi, not because he comes from Kenya, but because in the strategic interests of the United States, Nairobi is the front line against the war in terror in Africa, because Kenya borders Somalia on the east. Nairobi is within earshot of an indicted president of Sudan, Omar Bashir. It shares a border with a longtime dictator in Uganda, where I come from, Yoweri Museveni on the side. Nairobi and Kenya is a neighbor to Ethiopia, where Ethiopia is having an ongoing war with Eritrea. So if Obama was going to go to Africa, for me, that would have been the place. It's just for sentimental reasons that he's in Ghana, probably responding to the African-American lobby in the White House by just going to Ghana. So what?
Now, we were talking about this in our sort of editorial group, and there was some suspicion that that perhaps the White House would have preferred to go to Nairobi, but that security concerns in Kenya really haven't made that possible yet. Have you heard anything about anything like that, Marcus or Owen?
It's certainly a real... It's reality, as I'm saying. I mean, the fact is, for all those reasons, Kenya is strategically important. East Africa is strategically important, but it's also a much less stable region. The White House is portraying the Ghanaian trip as and the choice of Ghana as a reward of sorts for a government that's transparent, a West African country that's stable. And one could also make an argument, and people haven't yet, but one can make an argument that because of the oil interests of the United States in West Africa and the possibility that Africa could end up, supplying a quarter of American oil going forward, that West Africa's interest is important for those economic strategic interests.
Right. Owen, are you saying, I mean, the president was in Africa when he went to Cairo, of course, in Egypt, and gave a speech where he touched on some very sensitive issues in the middle of Egypt. Cairo, not known for its democratic governance throughout the continent or throughout the world. Are you saying that Barack Obama is maybe less inclined to touch sensitive issues in sub-Saharan Africa than he was in North Africa?
I would imagine so, because his choice of destination doesn't offer him that opportunity to touch sensitive issues.
So sensitive issues are you really looking for the U.S. government to tackle one way or another?
One is electoral reforms, mm-hmm. and democracy, because he's preaching to the converted in Ghana. We need more of that in East Africa, where you have... a government, for example, in Kenya, where he comes from, that is illegitimate. They stole an election. We all saw that. There was violence, ethnic violence that was stoked by leaders. Kofi Annan has just recently handed over an envelope containing names of people who have been indicted. You have impunity going on in southern Sudan with the Darfur crisis. I mean, this was the ultimate point where he was supposed to sit and address these issues in the Kenyan parliament, for example. And that way the surrounding areas would, the surrounding dictators would probably hear that. But his choice of Ghana, he's preaching to the converted. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was a wise decision.
The Bush administration actually gained a lot of popularity in Africa in its last years by increasing the amount of foreign aid and focusing on HIV/AIDS. Do you think that the president can extend upon that legacy in Africa, Owen?
I don't think so, because the American house is on fire, and in Africa we have a saying that if your house is on fire, why should you go out and put one fire out at the neighbor's place? in terms of expecting a lot from America, we don't expect anything this time around, because you need the money here than we do in Africa. So whereas Bush's legacy is very positive and he's highly rated in East Africa, for example, where I come from, because of his AIDS policy, free antiretroviral drugs and malaria nets, we expect that this is going to be cut back, because America has priorities here at home.
So, Marcus, we'll give you the last word here. Is the improving American economy, in fact, the best aid for Africa, putting out the economic fire in the United States?
Oh, no question. I think what we're seeing with this trip and how domestic issues have continually interfered, how healthcare reform issues now are at the forefront. Obama's domestic agenda is in trouble. We're seeing the link between economy, between foreign policy, between what happens here and what happens abroad. And that's why I think we're really, driving home this week.
Well, it's been a very interesting trip covering a whole lot of issues. And it's interesting to hear your level of, I would say, low expectations. Owen Kipenge, thanks so much for being here. A journalist who is in New York but came from Uganda last August, speaking a little skeptically about Barack Obama, who will speak live on television to the people of Ghana and the rest of sub-Saharan Africa later today. And, of course, Marcus Mabry, our friend here at The Takeaway from The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. But it's divided,
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here, flying solo on The Takeaway. Staying with Africa for just a moment, a group calling itself Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The Maghreb, of course, refers to the deserts of North Africa, has carried out a slew of attacks in northern Africa in recent weeks that has alarm bells going off across the globe. Some of those bells and some of the attacks, in any case, may have been carried out by fighters leaving Iraq and setting up shop in North Africa. The terrorist group has committed kidnappings and murders, including the killing of an American aid worker in Mauritania. Joining us now, New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt, who begins our discussion from Virginia. Eric, tell us the significance, at least as far as the security personnel are viewing this, of what seems to be some kind of a migration from the Middle East to areas of North Africa of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups.
Right. What you have here, John, is one of these Al-Qaeda franchises that was set up a few years ago. This was a group that was based in Algeria. It is based in Algeria, fighting the secular government there. And a couple of years ago, it branched out, looking to expand its reach throughout northern Africa and hook up with an alliance with Al-Qaeda. And what we've seen in those couple of years is an increasing number of attacks against the security forces of countries such as Algeria, Mauritania, Mali. These are largely, many of them are poor countries with weak militaries. Algeria is not, but many of the others are. But also so troubling is an attack against Westerners, as you mentioned, the kidnapping and killings of the Briton and the American. And the larger fear, of course, is this could leap from Africa into Europe. It hasn't happened yet, but a lot of the counterterrorism officials that we spoke to are watching this closely.
Now, of course, let's just describe the geography there. Algeria, which used to be a French colony, there are close sort of political connections or historical connections between Algeria and France, and also that area of the Mediterranean between Tunisia and Europe and Algeria and Europe is pretty narrow.
That's right. You've got a natural bridge. There are a lot of North Africans who have resettled in Europe, and so the concern is that there's a latent network in Europe that could be activated should this group decide to conduct operations in there. So far, they have limited their reach to these countries in northern Africa, and particularly countries in these vast expanses of the Sahara, where these governments, many of whom do not have large militaries or police forces. And with these large expanses, these groups are able to set up camps out in the desert and from there use them to stage attacks against the security forces or grab Westerners, often holding them for ransom. That's how they pay for much of their operations.
So I'm looking at the White House schedule this morning. Ironically, the president actually had a working breakfast with some officials from Algeria, along with Angola, Nigeria, and Senegal, as part of this agricultural discussion. I'm wondering if there was any sort of wink and a nod to this issue. I mean, neither of us would have any inside information on that. But I guess it raises the question, what influence would the U.S. have one way or another in Algeria or in the Maghreb to try to restrict the movement of groups like this?
Well, it's interesting, John. The U.S. has created a program where they've been working with many of the governments in that part of Africa, and it's an approach where it's both using diplomatic entities, aid programs, and then military training programs where Army Green Berets are helping to train some of the militaries of these North African countries to deal with some of these counterinsurgencies. Algeria is a little bit different. Obviously, they have a long and troubled history with insurgents, and they believe they are quite expert in dealing with this. In fact, it was because they had been fairly effective in hurting this group that they decided to branch out from Algeria and seek other avenues in some of these other countries that maybe weren't quite as well equipped to deal with them.
Well, that raises the other question that I have for you before we go. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about security officials, insofar as they're candid about this, having tripwires to watch either how this affiliate of Al-Qaeda or this franchise of Al-Qaeda might move to something broader than simply attacking local institutions and, you know, maybe scaling up their operations. And, of course, the thing of most concern to Americans, I would think, is if there would be a base in North Africa that would be capable of launching something like another 9/11. What are the tripwires that might be going on?
Well, they're watching this very closely, and as you mentioned in your lead into this report, there have been some intelligence reports suggesting that small numbers of North Africans who had fought in Iraq are now returning home armed with the skills that they learned there. So far, intelligence officials do not believe there's any type of camp or organization that's capable of launching an attack that would directly impact the United States homeland. But they are concerned that this group could increase its attacks on Westerners, Western business interests, Western tourists who are traveling through North Africa, and then again to expand and make the ultimate leap of into Europe and hit targets there. This organization does have financial and logistical supporters in Europe dating back to its Algerian insurgency's days. So it's something that these officials are watching quite closely.
Well, we're talking with Eric Schmidt, a reporter for The New York Times, on the apparent migration of some fighters from Iraq into North Africa, where Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has carried out a slew of attacks in northern Africa. I mean, what's the next step here as a kind of a takeaway for the story, Eric Schmidt?
Well, I think the takeaway here is kind of watching what happens in some of these countries in terms of will they step up their operations? Will they seek more assistance, for instance, from the United States, increase training of their military and police forces? Will the U.S. increase aid, surveillance aid, for instance, to kind of watch these vast expanse of desert to help these countries identify where some of these groups are located and help track them down, providing intelligence and doing that? And then, of course, watching what's going on in Europe, and the European counterterrorism agencies watch these cells quite closely to see if there's anything that would suggest a shift in what they might be doing.
Well, lots to be watching there. Eric Schmidt, reporter for our partners, The New York Times, thanks so much for being with us, talking about Al-Qaeda moving from Iraq to North Africa. Mark Garrison now has our headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, in news this morning that General Motors is now out of bankruptcy protection. The AP reports that, citing a person briefed on the matter. GM's CEO will hold a press conference next hour with details, including new word on white-collar job cuts. LA investigators have subpoenaed Michael Jackson's medical records. Police haven't ruled out the possibility of homicide in his death. Father Joe Jackson tells ABC he suspects, quote, foul play. In China, reports of more than 400,000 people who will have to move after a 6.0 magnitude quake hit in the southwest. State media says the earthquake leveled 18,000 homes. At the G8 meeting in Italy, world leaders are boosting aid to agriculture in the developing world. Leaders are launching a $20 billion aid package. That is an increase from the $15 billion they were talking about earlier today. Those are some of the headlines we have right now in the G8. Of course, President Obama is there, but he's going elsewhere next, which I know John's going to tell us about.
That's right. We're going to talk about his meeting later today with Pope Benedict at the Vatican. So he goes to from the G8 to actually meet with the Pope. And the First Family is going to meet with the Pope as well.
You bet.
Stay tuned for that.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Again, looking at the president's schedule today, we've been talking about Africa so far this morning. But before the president leaves for Africa, he's actually in a few hours going to have a private audience with Pope Benedict in the Vatican. He, of course, is in Italy at the G8 summit, and the G8 activities are just finishing up this morning. And then right after that, he'll have an audience with his entire family. Michelle and the girls will meet Pope Benedict. It's an important meeting. It's certainly an initial meeting for this president and Pope Benedict. Joining us now to talk about it is Kathleen Caveney, who's the John P. Murphy Foundation Professor of Law and Professor of Theology at Notre Dame University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
You know, it seems to me at the very least, these two share a sense of personal ambition. The encyclical that Pope Benedict released, I believe it was late last week. Are you familiar with it?
Oh, yes. Caritas in Veritate, or Love in Truth, Charity in Truth, is the encyclical.
I mean, it was a wide-ranging discussion of all kinds of issues that ranged from reforming capitalism to actually positioning the Vatican to be an institution of world governance, possibly.
Well, I don't think it wanted to do that. It wanted to call for some institution of world governance, but it doesn't want the Vatican to be that institution.
Well, it was actually ambitious just to even raise the issue, and it seems to me the ambitions and the sort of wide-ranging agenda of Pope Benedict matches President Obama's wide-ranging agenda so far in his presidency, which has been criticized by some as being doing like way too much at once. When these two get together, they'll have a certain amount of common ground, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I think it'll be a really fascinating conversation, because I think they basically, you know, have an idea of the same problem. If you look at Caritas in Veritate and you look at Obama's speech at Notre Dame, you know, you see that the basic problem that they see is, you know, for the whole globe, is how are we going to live together as one human family? That was the phrase used by Obama at Notre Dame, and that's really the problem addressed by the Pope in the encyclical.
Well, how do you complete, you know, sort of draw an arc from the president's very controversial, at least in terms of how the press covered it, controversial commencement speech at Notre Dame to this meeting with Pope Benedict? And let's just note that polls indicate Catholics mostly supported President Obama during the election. He won a majority of Catholics in the United States. What's the arc here?
Well, what I see the arc is it's not a question of agreeing, you know, of the Vatican agreeing with the president on all issues. Obviously, they don't agree on the issue of abortion. But I think there are two big questions there, or big points of commonality. One is that, you know, the Pope and the president agree that, you know, that we've got to face this question about how we're going to live together as a human family. The Pope and the president agree that, you know, the president is a Christian as well, that, you know, sin and selfishness and questions of benightedness, you know, on a moral level have created part of the problem. And the Pope and the president agree that you need both morality and technical competence in order to solve those problems. So there's a general framework for, you know, what we need in order to solve our problems, which is we need to be smart and we need to be good. And I think that that creates a sense of a possibility of a conversation.
You know, I'm used in my, you know, journalistic career of seeing these meetings with the Pope as much more symbolic, or, you know, maybe contentious if the issue of abortion is at center stage. But I'm wondering if there's precedent going back through U.S. history of substantive kind of policy initiatives being driven by a relationship between a U.S. president and a Pope.
Well, I think there are always similarities and differences. And, you know, with President Bush, there was agreement more on abortion, but disagreement on, say, the Iraq War and other issues like that. With President Obama, I think, you know, you've got agreement on the importance of coming to terms with globalization. And I think what the Catholic Church offers, according to the Pope, is, you know, Catholic means universal. Part of what Christianity and Catholicism can offer is some sense of, you know, the universal dignity of all human beings as made in the image and likeness of God. And that's a basis, love, you know, respect for one another as brothers and sisters, that religious people can bring to the table, that Christians can bring to the table. And I don't think on that level there's going to be too much disagreement between the Pope and the president. But also, you know, a sense of, you know, commitment to the truth. And I think what the Vatican liked about President Obama is, you know, President Obama is not a moral relativist. He says to the pro-life group, he said to the people at Notre Dame, make your point about abortion. I want to hear your point about abortion. But also listen. also pay attention to what other people have to say. Recognize that you're claiming the truth, but also be humble about your own knowledge. And I think that kind of moral realism, that humble moral realism, you know, that enables conversation on all sides is something that the Vatican seems to be excited about.
Well, of course, the part of the history here, and, you know, it's happened over and over again. Maybe it's getting a little old, but still, the Pope is sitting down with the first African-American president in the United States. It occurs to me, looking at the growth of Catholicism in Africa, though, that in our lifetimes, Kathleen Caveney at Notre Dame, we could see an African-American Pope sitting down with an African-American president, right?
We could certainly see that, and I think that, that's another aspect of the Obama administration that's exciting. You know, the sense of, you know, there has been moral progress. There is some way of seeing this. We've gone in the United States from, you know, a thoroughly racist society that, you know, Dr. King protested against to a society where, you know, the equality of African Americans is embodied in our choice of the president. Whatever else you think about his policies, that's progress.
Right. Well, great stuff. Kathleen Caveney, John P. Murphy Foundation Professor of Law and Professor of Theology at Notre Dame University. Thanks for being with us, talking about the president meeting later today with Pope Benedict at the Vatican. Joining us now, David Willey from our partners, the BBC. David, what are the expectations from this meeting? And I understand it's not only a meeting with Barack Obama, but also with the family.
Indeed it is. I think there are high expectations, actually, from the Vatican. I think the Pope is genuinely interested in meeting the new president for the first time. He called him on the telephone to congratulate him on his election last year. But I think the Pope is fascinated by the idea of the first African-American president of the United States coming to see him. It's a big opportunity because the Pope's very interested in Africa himself, in development questions. And it isn't really going to be religious problems which are going to be the main subject of discussion between the two during their meeting at the Vatican. It's going to be world economic problems. For his part, President Obama is also very interested in the Pope's recent document, which is his encyclical letter, in which he spells out the ethical and the moral responsibilities for the global economic meltdown. So they're going to have a lot to talk about.
Well, we're going to leave it there. My guest, David Willey, a correspondent for our partners, the BBC, also one of the most experienced Vatican reporters in the business, talking about Barack Obama's upcoming visit with the Pope. Thanks, David. And upcoming for us, the big movie this weekend is going to be Bruno, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, the same man who brought you Borat. Bruno is a fictional gay Austrian fashion reporter, and we're going to be talking to a very real Austrian celebrity who he's supposedly based on. What will Bruno do to Americans' image of gays? A controversy coming up in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Coming up, who has Sacha Baron Cohen offended this time? The release of Bruno causes some people to talk, and we'll have two of them on the program in just a moment. But first, listen to this.
If I'm hungry, I know, number one, that I have done what I meant to do. I've eaten less than my body thought it wanted.
Leave the table hungry. That's a member of the Caloric Restriction Society speaking on 60 Minutes earlier this year. If you leave the table hungry, does it extend your life? Well, a new study, Ricky Coleman, an associate scientist at the University of Wisconsin, suggests that an explicit program of caloric restriction that goes perhaps beyond leaving the table hungry actually may have life extension potential. Ricky Coleman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, explain what the study was and how much life extension is presaged by the numbers that you saw.
So what the study is, it's the largest and most highly controlled study to show the beneficial effects of calorie restriction in a primate species, and humans are primates. So the fact that we've now shown that this works in a primate species is particularly relevant to human health. We've known for probably about 70 years now that reducing the amount of calories you eat increases your lifespan in lower models, such as yeast and fruit flies and rodents. This is the first time we know that it works in a species closely related to humans.
Now, groups like the Caloric Restriction Society suggest that the reasons for this, and I don't know what they're basing it on, relate to how humans evolved, and that, in fact, we're more naturally evolved to be continually hungry because of the historic competition for food as humans evolved. Is there any information in this study that might suggest that that is indeed the case?
Well, actually, at this point, the main purpose of the study right now is to show that it actually works. We had no proof yet that it actually worked in a primate species. So for now, we just showed that it worked. And now that we know that, now we can begin to look at the reasons why it works and how it works. And we're actually thinking along the lines of some form of altered energy metabolism or an altered use of the calories that we do take in, and somehow that's altering the aging process. But at this point, we haven't yet really explored what's going on.
Can I drag you into one other speculative zone for a moment against your will, because you are a responsible scientist and I'm just a journalist? People talk about oxidants and the byproducts of incomplete combustion. If you eat more food, there's more combustion to produce energy. Therefore, there's more waste products. Is it conceivable that may be one of the agents here?
That's one of the main theories. I'm not sure that's the leading theory at the moment, but that was one of the earlier theories for sure, that the free radical production related to the amount of calories you eat is related to the aging rate.
You very responsibly answered that, I thought. I don't think you jeopardized your career at all. Were you surprised by this result in any way?
In some ways, we were very surprised. In other ways, not so much. I mean, some of the things seem fairly obvious. You eat less, you're going to weigh less. If you eat less, you're less likely to develop diabetes, although we were very surprised by the extent of that decrease in diabetes.
Sure.
The brain results we showed, we were very surprised by.
All right, well, it's really interesting stuff. We've been thinking about it all day. Ricky Coleman, associate scientist at the University of Wisconsin, talking about a study that really answers the dreams of the people from the movie Cocoon.
We'll never be sick. We won't get any older, and we won't ever die.
Are any of the cast members alive from that movie?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Let's begin with some headlines. Mark Garrison is here.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama says a full economic recovery is still in the distance. Speaking at the G8 in Italy a moment ago, he said fixing it requires global leadership.
So right now, at this defining moment, we face a choice. We can either shape our future or let events shape it for us.
Later today, the president meets with the Pope at the Vatican before heading to Ghana in West Africa. Back in the U.S., news this morning that General Motors is now out of bankruptcy protection. The AP reports that, citing a person briefed on the matter. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from GM's CEO in a press conference with details, including new word on white-collar job cuts and possible other moves to restructure. Illinois Senator Roland Burris has his own press conference this afternoon. Multiple reports say he'll announce he won't seek re-election next year. Former Illinois Governor, of course, Rod Blagojevich, gave him the job. Multiple challengers in Burris' own party were in line to run against him in the Democratic primary. In Illinois, four cemetery workers are charged with secretly digging up graves and moving them so they could resell the plots. The Burr Oak Cemetery is just outside Chicago. It holds about 1,000 burials a year, so authorities say it could take months to investigate. There were some historic figures buried there, such as lynching victim Emmett Till. The local sheriff says Till's grave is untouched. Finally, in sports, riders are in the final summit of the first big mountain stage at the Tour de France, with a lead pack of 9 racers battling it out. Lance Armstrong, not in that front pack. He was second going into today's stage, though, John.
Thank you, Mark Garrison. So some might say the humor is kind of a last refuge of people who want to exploit the powerless. If they're powerless, just make jokes about them. Now, maybe the people of Kazakhstan aren't powerful, but they were certainly no match for Sacha Baron Cohen's last movie, Borat. They didn't have much power to fight against a voice like this.
Do you ever laugh on people with a retardation?
Here in America, we try not to, make fun of or be funny with things that people don't choose.
But perhaps you have not seen someone with a very funny retardation. My brother Bilo have a very funny retardation.
Borat, in the guise of Sacha Baron Cohen, of course, that's his movie, Borat, making fun not only of Kazakhstanis, but of the mentally retarded. His new movie, Bruno, takes on another group.
You are the baby's father now, and you chose to dress that baby up in a T-shirt that says what?
Baby.
That's not the baby's name, is it?
No. I gave him like a traditional African name.
So what's the baby's name?
OJ.
There, Sacha Baron Cohen is playing Bruno. It's the title of his latest movie. It certainly takes on the issue of gays in the world. Joining us now is Alphonse Haider, who's an Austrian TV host of the show Strictly Come Dancing. It's the number one television show in Austria. And now, Alphonse, you've been described as the person that Sacha Baron Cohen's character Bruno is actually based on?
Hi, John, yes. I don't know why. I mean, I denied that since the first second I heard it 6 weeks ago. It's impossible that this is me. I mean, I'm Austrian, I'm male, I'm a TV host, and I'm openly gay, but that's all. There are nothing else in comparison. It's fictional. But, you know, media, if somebody says that's not true, everybody thinks, yeah, that has to be true. But I think this movie is going to be important because he has a clever way, a brutal, clever way to show homophobia. And he does that in a very brutal way. And I think this film is not offending Austria, not my country, not the Austrians. A few Nazi jokes, yes, okay, but we've got humor enough to love about that.
All right, Alphonse Haider, you're on the line from Parach in Austria?
In Parchach, yes. Okay. Carinthia. It's a little state of Austria, and I'm preparing a big television show there tomorrow for Germany, Austria, and Switzerland.
All right, well, stay with us from Parchach in Austria. In the studio with me is Rashad Robinson, Senior Director of Media Programs for GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Good morning to you, Rashad.
Good morning.
Now, a movie like Bruno comes out, and you can hear the reactions. I mean, some people say, oh, my God, he's so over the line, but others saying, oh, relax, it's just humor. You know, don't be so politically correct. Where do you fall here, and how do you find lines in Sacha Baron Cohen stuff?
You know, it was incredibly tough. You know, we were invited by Universal to come and see the movie back in April.
Really?
Yes, because they...
They invited you. They must have been worried.
Well, they were a little worried, but they also thought that they had some pieces that were good as well and exposed homophobia, which was their intent, and which is their intent. And I think judging this movie as a single movie is incredibly tough. It really is about 80-some-odd minutes of individual sketches, some of which hit their mark and are satirically on point, and some of which miss their mark in really big ways and hit the community instead in ways that feel kind of antithetical to the intentions of the filmmakers.
Do you think a movie like this says it's okay to make fun of gays, or a movie like this says maybe I should learn more about my neighbors who happen to be gay?
You know, I think that's the tough thing. I think that, you know, you can make a movie in Hollywood, and it can mean one thing in Hollywood and New York, and a different thing in Little Rock and Birmingham,
or in Austria,
and in Austria. And I think that, you know, the challenge for us here is that, you know, when I first saw the Bruno character on the Ali G show on HBO some years back, you know, I felt like, you know, watching it at 10 o'clock on HBO, that, you know, we were in on the joke as the community. Now I feel like we are the joke by looking at how they've tried to translate this movie.
Finish your thought. I want to hear Alphonse's thought.
As someone who's seen the movie, Alphonse, the full movie, I can say that, you know, how they've translated this movie into a feature-length movie that's going to open July 10th for our American audience all across the country in places where gay and lesbian people are not visible. In 30 states, you can still lose your job simply for being gay. Do we really think a bunch of crude jokes are going to kind of elevate the conversation around homophobia?
Go ahead,
Alphonse.
I
completely disagree. First of all, this movie I saw it too. I'm also gay, and I'm also openly gay, and I'm in a country where it's really difficult to be gay still because we're Catholic. But this movie has shown here in Europe, at least, that we talk about the whole issue again, that people go again on the streets, that people discuss again. We have to have more humor. I'm really sorry. I don't agree with you. We have to have more humor and love on the way we live and the way we want to be. And he is not against homosexuality. homosexuals. He's showing homophobia. He's turning around, and excuse me, if there are stupid people enough in the U.S. who leave a theater and think gays are like that, then you can't help them anyway.
Rashad?
I appreciate Alphonse's comment, and I think that does illustrate an important point that we had with the movie, is that there's something lost in translation here, across the country, right? Because people are going to feel differently in different parts of the country. Our concern is not about the homophobes who go into the theater and laugh at gay people before and laugh at people after. Ours are, I saw the movie in a focus group, big focus group setting where they took people off the street. And I sat behind a group of kind of 17 to 18-year-old males. And I watched them as they were, laughing, not at, the kind of expose of homophobia, but laughing at the kind of jokes that were not really about exposing homophobia.
Well, we just got an email from someone named Spence who said, GLAAD should take care of important business instead of going after easy, stupid targets like Bruno. What do you think of that?
Well, we are taking care of important topics. I mean, our what I will say is that, our concern with this movie is not rooted in a lack of appreciation for satire or comedy.
Right.
I send talented staff all across the country to help communities deal with hate violence or to work with communities as they're fighting back anti-gay ballot measures and to work with the media. We understand that words and images matter, and that's why we're here.
Alphonse, it seems like part of what's going on in this movie is that it may be controversial to make fun of gays in the United States, but it apparently is totally fine to make fun of Germans.
Well, I don't care. I think we should see it as a different thing. It's a fiction. It's a comedy. It's not a documentary. We have to see it like that. And again, as long as people talk about it, and now with this movie, the whole world talks about the gay issue again. I agree. There's one point I'm disappointed because I think Sacha Cohen is a clever man. I really thought at the end of the film, he will turn around in one way and say, listen, I'm Sacha Cohen and I like you guys. And this is a fiction. We're just showing you're not like that. He doesn't do that. But please don't forget, he's not making a documentary for gays and lesbians. He's selling his movie, and that's it.
And I think
we have to live with that.
And I think that's an important point, that the movie is not just to expose homophobia, right? You don't release a movie. Universal doesn't release a big budget hit on July 10th just to have a thought piece. They're also trying to
right.
make a lot of money. And we asked Sacha Baron Cohen, we asked the studio to put a piece at the end to speak directly to tolerance. And they
refused?
Yes, they refused.
But they did take scenes out that you asked to be taken out.
Did not take scenes out. They took a couple of references out, but they did not take out scenes.
Well, Bruno opens in theaters today, and the conversation will certainly continue on our website, thetakeaway.org. Alphonse Haider is the host of the Austrian TV show Strictly Come Dancing. Perhaps he is the person the Bruno character is partly based on. He denies it, of course. And Rashad Robinson, Senior Director of Media Programs for GLAAD, gay and lesbian anti-defamation group, who was there in the focus groups from the beginning on the movie. All this morning, we're asking you to be our eyes. You're investigating the state of the American mall in this economy. We want you to tell us how your mall has changed in the past year. Is the Abercrombie and Fitch blasting its music, or is it gone? Did your mall lose its JCPenney's? The retail sales numbers are way, way down, and we want to know how that looks in your community. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Podcast anything on the program. If you go to Bruno, leave a response on our website as well. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Birthing babies in Africa for a presidential visit?
Born free as the wind blows.
Joseph, who we spoke to in Cape Coast, he was saying that he is hoping that his heavily pregnant wife will give birth on the day Obama comes to town. How about that?
So, Alex Jacana, host of Africa Have Your Say, a show from our partners, the BBC, you told us 2 hours ago that that was just one of the excited Africans anticipating Barack Obama's arrival later today in Ghana. Alex, is there an update on the condition of the pregnant mom there?
I'm afraid I haven't got one for you, John. I'm sure we'll be finding out after the speech has been delivered. We'll get in touch and find out what happened after that.
But the anticipation all over the world and certainly all over the sub-Saharan African continent is very high for Barack Obama's arrival, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes, it is. It's definitely very, very high. I've been looking at the website, and it's just constantly being hit by emails coming in constantly. And even though we have been off air for over, nearly 20 hours now, we're still receiving texts coming in, and they're all talking about excitement.
Well, we will have more of those texts in just a minute. And if that baby is born, be sure to let us know, will you?
Oh, we'll definitely do.
Alex Jacana, who is host of Africa Have Your Say, a show from our partners, the BBC. The movie Born Free gets a sequel with some political lions today, a dramatic backdrop in Ghana, and some hard issues in sub-Saharan Africa. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, July 10th. I'm John Hockenberry. Our Africa coverage continues when we hear from Nobel Prize winner Dr. Wangari Maathai. She's in Kenya, and she's going to speak about the president's visit to the African continent. We're also going to talk with Alex again. And Sacha Baron Cohen pushes the line between offensive and funny in his new movie, Bruno. Maybe he goes too far. And also, a very important update on the H1N1 virus, which is the focus in Washington, D.C. Those stories coming up, but let's get you caught up with everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, world leaders at the G8 summit have an initiative to help farmers increase food production in developing countries. President Obama says many of them can be self-sustainable.
There is no reason why Africa cannot be self-sufficient when it comes to food.
The initiative announced today is worth $20 billion. The president spoke at a news conference and will soon be on his way to Africa. News this morning, the General Motors is now out of bankruptcy protection. A news conference is going on right now showing that the company has sold its valuable assets and has details. The U.S. trade deficit with its lowest level is at its lowest level in nearly a decade. American exports grew this just in, while imports here have dropped, dragged down by the sagging U.S. economy. And the Washington Post this morning is reporting that insurance giant AIG plans to pay millions of dollars in bonuses for several dozen executives. What else is new? Wall Street mostly flat yesterday, and it looks like when Wall Street opens based on the futures trading, there will be a bounce downward. Tell us the story of your mall in your community. We're asking because retail sales numbers were way down yesterday. How has that changed the mall in your part of America? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The president soon will be on his way to Africa, where he will land at just after sunset local time in Ghana in West Africa. Here he is speaking before his departure, talking about African countries and a $20 billion initiative on agricultural aid for developing countries.
In many African countries, if you want to start a business or get a job, you still have to pay a bribe. There remains a lack of transparency.
The question for Africans who are very much anticipating the president's arrival in West Africa is how he will broach the subject of issues like transparency and democratization. We're going to talk more about this with Alex Jacana, who is still with us. He's from our partners, the BBC at Bush House in London, host of the BBC show Africa Have Your Say, which has been receiving messages, emails and texts and calls from people all over Africa. Alex, good morning again. And let's talk issues for a moment. We certainly had there at the top the idea that people are very emotional about Barack Obama's arrival, including that gentleman who wants his wife to give birth. But what are the issues on the minds of people?
Well, the issues on the minds of the people, John, I'll give you an example of Edith, who we spoke to in Ghana, a young person, very excited, but she says that she wants Obama to speak to African leaders. Now, we just heard him there, a bit of what he was saying before he left to come to Africa, and she was saying that she wants him to come and talk to, come with a stern message for African leaders, you know, the sort of get your act together message. Well, highly unlikely it will happen that way, but she's hoping that's what will happen. We've got people like Sam Moore sent us a text from Sierra Leone, and it's about agriculture, which again we've just had President Obama talk about there. Sam says, and I'll read it for you just the way he sent it off his mobile phone. He says, if President Obama wants to help Africa in the agricultural sector, he should cut off subsidies to American farmers or extend the same to African farmers. So this is
something that's really interesting, Alex, because we were talking this morning with some African journalists who are saying, forget about the aid. We want the American economy to improve. If the American economy improves, that has a direct demand impact on countries in Africa trying to export to the United States.
And you'll find that actually a lot of Africans would be feeling the same way. A lot of Africans, actually, those who are in trade and business, want a strong, an economically strong United States of America, because an economically strong United States of America is going to mean a bigger and more energetic market for what they have to offer. So you've got that feeling as well coming through to those who are especially involved in business in Africa. I'll give you a message that came in, for example, from Abdul. Abdul texted us from Nigeria. Now, unlike everyone else, was saying he doesn't want Obama to talk when he comes to Africa. Listen to what he says. He says, paradoxically, I would rather President Obama says nothing when he comes to Ghana. The talking can wait until he gets back to D.C. I want him to come and see. Let him see the African condition.
Wow. I guess the question there is, will the president, whatever he sees, really address issues like democratization? Confront, say, African leaders who may or may not agree with the political program of Barack Obama?
Well, that is a question that we'll have to wait and see. A lot of African leaders have been challenged by the oppositions in their countries and been accused constantly about the way they run the country, about the level of democracy there. So, and this has been happening for decades. So we wait to see if...
Right.
Another president or a new president from the United States, and admittedly a hugely globally popular president from the United States, adding his voice to those that have come several times before him, will make any difference, because one could argue it's what President Clinton did, and in a way it was what George Bush did when he came. Will Obama make a difference? We'll have to wait and see.
Very quickly, Alex, something whimsical from the reactions you've been getting on Africa, have your say. Nothing whimsical?
Nothing whimsical.
Nothing whimsical. The voice of Africa.
I can tell you one thing, though. We spoke to Kutso in Johannesburg.
Quickly.
Who said, what's the big deal? We don't care in South Africa.
That's what I love. Alex Jacana, host of Africa Half Your Say on our partners, the BBC. Thanks so much for joining us from London. Love and Live Radio. Continuing our discussion from Nairobi, Kenya, is Dr. Wangari Maathai. We welcome Dr. Maathai back to the program. She, of course, the Nobel Prize-winning activist, founder of the Green Belt Movement, author of the book The Challenge for Africa, joining us now, and one of the people very much interested in Barack Obama landing in Ghana later on in the program. Doctor, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you very much.
You know, I remember when you were sitting right across from me and we were talking about, the campaign and, some of the emotional issues. I'm wondering if you could draft a memo for President Barack, now President Barack Obama, of issues and things that you want dealt with by the American government. What do you think that would be?
Well, I think that as the president comes to the continent, one of the things that I think should be focused on is governance, to encourage the African leadership to address the issue of good governance, democratic governance, respect for human rights. Right here in Kenya, we are dealing with extrajudicial killings, mostly by the police, issues like corruption. So I think these are some of the issues that are, of course, are closely associated with our region. And I hope that these are some of the issues that he will address and encourage the African leadership to seriously address.
Now, Dr. Wangari Maathai, if the president does address some of these sensitive issues, he'll be speaking on Ghanaian television. Ghanaians won't have much access to him. It's going to be from the inside of a very secure building. Is it likely that Kenyan media will carry that speech live, or would they be more likely to edit it?
Well, I would hope that Kenyan media would cut it alive. There is a lot of interest here in Kenya. Of course, Kenyans would have hoped that he would come here first for the obvious reasons. So I'm sure they will be very keen to hear what he says from Ghana. And we are very clear that he will be talking to the entire sub-Saharan Africa. So, yeah, I do hope that it will be live.
What do you think the influence Barack Obama has on particular African leaders? Are they keen to create bilateral relationships with him, or are they more concerned about being lectured to by someone like Barack Obama? Certainly there's a long tradition of American presidents lecturing to African leaders.
Well, I think that most African leaders, I can't think of any that was not excited when President Obama was elected. And I am quite sure that they are inspired by him. Most of them, of course, are old enough to be their his daddy. But I think that right. He has been a great inspiration, not only to the young people, but also to the adults and the older generation. So I'm sure they will be listening. Obviously, they would prefer that he dances in lecture to them, but he will definitely be addressing issues that will look like he's lecturing to them when he tells them to practice better governance, to respect human rights. When he, for example, tells Kenyans that he may not come here until we are prepared to address the issues of post-election violence, to eliminate impunity among our leaders, some of whom are going to face the arrest because of having participated in those post-election violence. Or when he tells us that we need to protect our forests because without that we may face food crisis and water crisis. It may appear like he is lecturing to them, but surely these are issues that are very real in Africa and the leadership needed to look at them.
Well, we've already seen the success of a female president in Liberia. I'm wondering if there's a message that you would hope for from Barack Obama to encourage more women to be in the public sector, the leadership class in Africa, as a way of moving forward on a variety of reforms.
Well, I have a lot of respect for our president, President Sirleaf Johnson in Liberia, and I know that she's doing a great job trying to put a broken country back on track. But it is also true that it is too early to think that only women can bring the African failed governance back on track. I think that sometimes when I look at some of the women who may be ministers in government, sometimes they don't do any better in terms of irresponsible leadership than the men. So I think that the challenge for Africa, as I have said in my recent book, is a challenge for all of us Africans, but especially those of us who are elites and who are in governance positions, that we really need to be responsible to our people and to govern them as if they matter.
And the takeaway there would be it's kind of a unity of the African diaspora and people in Africa to upgrade this civic sector and to create, I guess what you're saying there is a new class of leadership. As you said, most of the African leaders could be Barack Obama's daddy. Dr. Wangari Maathai, Nobel Prize-winning activist, founder of the Green Belt Movement, and author of the book The Challenge for Africa, speaking there to us from Nairobi, Kenya. The president himself just gave a news conference in L'Aquila, Italy, before heading to Ghana. He was asked plenty of domestic questions about health care, about the economy, and more. We're going to have a report on that just coming up this hour.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. As the eyes of sub-Saharan Africa await the touchdown of Barack Obama's Air Force One shortly after sunset local time in Ghana, the eyes of Washington are on a speech that the president gave and also a news conference about a little less than an hour ago in L'Aquila, Italy, before he departed for the Vatican, where he's going to actually have an audience with Pope Benedict shortly this morning. So from climate change to the economy to Iran to American health care, many, many issues of concern to people here in the United States. And joining us to help analyze the speech is April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. She joins us from Washington, along with our friend and Takeaway Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. April and Todd, good morning.
Good morning.
So, April, let's begin with you. What was the issue that most concerned the reporters asking the president? And a lot of domestic issues were covered this morning.
Yeah, it was very interesting because, you know, no matter whether the president is overseas or here at home, the economy is first and foremost. You know, you've got issues, announcements from GM today. You've got, you know, the vice president just this week talking about how unemployment numbers. And then you've got on Capitol Hill a talk about a second stimulus. So this president is going to be dealing with this, whether it's at home, on American soil, or abroad. And you've got to remember, this is his number one priority, along with the war that he's trying to refocus in on now with Afghanistan.
Were there any questions on Afghanistan, April?
No, but you had an issue towards the very end, really on Iran, and that really was very, very interesting to hear how he tried to talk about how the G8 members were making statements on Iran. But you have to remember, the Iran issue is about what kind of level of engagement. No matter what, they have to engage. The world community has to engage with Iran because you have issues of terrorism and you have issues of nuclear weapons. And if you do not engage with Iran, you don't know what's going on. At least, I mean, you know, what we've heard from the national security community is that, you know, our intelligence on Iran is not good at all. And, you know, we've talked about faulty intelligence in other parts of the world, but our intelligence on Iran is very faulty. And then if we don't engage with them, it would be much worse.
Well, you know, it's interesting. April Ryan, who's the White House correspondent from American Urban Radio Networks, were talking about what Barack Obama said at a news conference that was held within the hour over in Italy. Many, many domestic issues. But, you know, he was not asked. It seems to me he really does get a pass from the global reporters on his own war in Afghanistan. There's an offensive going on in Afghanistan right now. But let's shift to domestic issues.
I never believe anything is do or die. But I really want to get it done by the August recess.
He's talking about health care there. Todd Zwillick, he didn't set a deadline to legislators in Congress who might be watching this news conference this morning, but he wants to get health care done by August. Any idea?
Well, what he kind of did was remove the deadline, because the August deadline has always been the one suggested by House and Senate leaders and by the White House. And I think they realize that that's starting to slip a little bit. And this is a fight among Democrats. We all know that the Democrats have the votes now. They've got that 60 in the Senate, and they've got huge majority in the House. But there's a big fight among different factions in the Democratic Party about how to pay for this $1 trillion. For health care reform that we've been talking about this whole time. House Democrats have a plan now that they want to have a surtax on wealthier people who make more than $250,000. And a lot of people in the Senate call that a non-starter. They're not even going to think about it. Meanwhile, the plan that this bipartisan group in the Senate had to maybe think about taxing health benefits, richer, you know, health benefits, sure, around $15,000, that's falling by the wayside. That August deadline looks like it's probably going to slip at this point.
All right, so do or die, not do or die. August is not do or die means that the health care deadline is slipping. We've got climate change, all sorts of compromise on climate change, both in the domestic agenda and at the G8 summit. You've got the economy continuing to deteriorate. April Ryan, I'm hearing climb down from some of the issues that were really, really important to Barack Obama during the campaign and in the first 100 days.
Well, this president has said
that, look, you know, when I want to come through on my promises, but at the same time, forgive me, I'm in the car with my daughter as we're talking.
You don't have to ask for forgiveness. Daughters are permitted on this program. That kid ban on Morning Edition, it doesn't apply here.
Well, here's the issue. This president has said, you know, I come into office and I have to deal with a lot of issues. Climate change is one of the issues that he wanted to deal with globally. A lot of the world leaders are not necessarily with him, and he made that point. That's something that he wanted to deal with. He's even met with Al Gore about this. This is a major issue. And, you know, he's even, just in the last couple of weeks, this president has talked about working on changing light bulbs in the White House to try to help with global warming and things of that nature. And this president is concerned about that. But, you know, he's got so many issues, and you have to figure out what battles to tackle and which ones to save for another day. So I think that's what he's trying to assess. He's trying to put all of them in the priority that he wants. But, you know, when you have to deal with other leaders and you can get some things through and some things not, you have to figure out what days and when you can push them
through. Pick your battles. April Ryan, we'll let you get on your way. White House correspondent for the American Urban Radio Networks, talking about Barack Obama's news conference within the hour. Todd Zwillick, before we go, does the president, based on what he said today, bring anything back from this trip?
Well, you know, the one thing that he really needs to bring back on the climate change issue is some sense that we're going to get cooperation from countries like China and India. Those are big polluters and going to be even bigger emitters of carbon into the future. And he's got a lot of moderate to conservative Democrats in his own party who don't want to vote for a climate change bill unless they get something out of China and India. Now, the G8 is not necessarily the forum for that, but there's certainly observers there. And he's not coming back with any kind of, you know, with any kind of real something to deliver to them. He's going to need some assurance for Midwestern Democrats that they're not going to vote for something and then, you know, that's going to limit their industries and then have India and China emitting more carbon.
Well, critics and skeptics at the G8 and in among the international leaders in Italy are certainly giving grist for the debate on climate change in the Congress among those skeptical Democrats. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick in Washington, and Mark Garrison now has our headlines.
Thank you, John. 29 minutes after the hour, President Obama says a full economic recovery is still in the distance. Speaking just a moment ago, or a few moments ago, the president hailed progress made this week at the G8. He visits the Pope in a little while, then heads to West Africa to visit Ghana later today. Back in the U.S., news this morning that General Motors is now out of bankruptcy protection. CEO Fritz Henderson says the new GM will launch 10 new vehicles in the U.S. And also reports out this morning that insurance giant AIG plans new bonuses.
Oh, John? Good. Well, of course. That's good. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us here on The Takeaway on this Friday, okay, which means you're heading into the weekend. You want to know what to do. We're here with our good friend, Tony Scott, film critic for our partners, The New York Times. And, you know, Bruno is kind of like, I got three words for you there, Tony Scott.
Yes, he's right in your face.
Sacha Baron Cohen is at it again. He took on the Kazakhs in Borat, okay? Kazakhs are a powerless group. He's taking on gays here with Bruno, and we should point out the character Bruno is not new. It was popular on his Ali G show.
Yeah, as was Borat, and he's now sort of taken it to feature length. And the story is very similar, maybe a little too similar to Borat. It's sort of, here's this rather odd individual from a foreign country. He's Austrian. He's obsessed with fashion, flamboyantly gay, and he comes to America, you know, and does the kind of fake interview sort of ambush gag that
these gotcha moments.
It's these gotcha moments. It's sort of, how far can you push an average ordinary American before he or she reveals their true, in this case, you know, homophobia, in the case of Borat, xenophobia. And
or how far can you push, say, an Israeli Mossad chief and a former Palestinian minister, as in, a Palestinian political minister, as in this little moment here? Listen.
Why are you so anti-Hamas? I mean, isn't pita bread the real enemy?
You're confusing Hamas with hummus, I believe. Hummus
do you think there
Hamas?
Is a relation between Hamas and hummus? So was the founder of Hamas a chef? He had created the food and then got lots of followers?
Hummus has nothing to do with Hamas. It's a food, okay? We eat it, they eat it.
It's vegetarian, it's healthy, wrong. It's mean.
That's Yossi Alfer and former Palestinian minister Ghassan Khatib in a scene from Bruno, A.O. Scott, the New York Times. I mean, in Borat, I thought to myself, how did he do that? Because right. The moments did seem documentary-like. Right. Is this legit here?
Well, I think these guys are in on the joke.
I
don't think, actually, that they, either one of these people believes that this is a fashion journalist from Austria who doesn't know the difference between Hamas and hummus. I think they're sort of playing along in a deadpan kind of way. And I think one of the problems with this movie, one of the reasons that it's less kind of audacious and outrageous than Borat, even though it tries very hard to be, is that there are just fewer people. There are not as many, you know, available patsies or suckers in the world. People are
right.
in on the joke. People know by now, a lot of people, who Sacha Baron Cohen is, and also are used to being kind of punked in this way. So you have to go very, very far. You either have to sort of, I think, as in this case, maybe fudge it a little bit and have the people playing along, or go sort of very deep into the wilderness to find people who don't know what's going on.
And then, of course, aside from the sort of methodology of the film, which is one source of the humor, and you're describing there how difficult it is to pull off these days, there's also just the pure kind of let's make fun of gays. And Alphonse Hader, who's an Austrian TV host who we spoke with this morning, he's the host of Strictly Come Dancing, and some believe, and he even sort of winks and nods and suggests this is the case, that he's the person that Bruno is sort of based on. He had this to say to us this morning.
We have to have more human love on the way we live and the way we want to be. And he's not against homosexuals. He's showing homophobia. He's turning around. And if there are stupid people enough in the U.S. who leave a theater and think gays are like that, then you can't help them anyway.
All right. So on the issue of homophobia and legitimately making a humorous movie about gays, does Sacha Baron Cohen succeed here?
Well,
Scott?
I think that he actually tries to have it both ways. I mean, I think we can get to the idea of stupid people in the U.S., which is another problem with this movie, maybe. But I think that he both wants to make fun of homophobia and also to exploit the humorous potential of a kind of, you know, anxiety or discomfort about homosexuality. I mean, the of course, you know, nobody in their right mind really would believe that all gay people are like Bruno. On the other hand, there are no other gay people in the movie until Elton John shows up at the very, very end. But it's sort of as if he's in this landscape where he's the only such person. And also, especially at the beginning, his sexuality and his sex, the sex that he has with one of his lovers, are played for a kind of an inherent sense of comedy. This is, you know, this is gross, this is outrageous, this is shocking. And that is exploiting homophobia to generate laughs. But then if you're laughing at these homophobic jokes, you can also laugh at the homophobes and in a way, you know, protect yourself from being implicated as homophobic. So it's a very kind of elegant two-step that he's doing, where you can laugh at these, you know, politically incorrect, shocking, potentially offensive things that are going on, partly because you know that there are going to be people who show up in the movie who are the real bigots.
Now, that, of course, is a great NYU film class lecture there, and I was fascinated and riveted
well,
by it.
You.
But did you laugh, Tony? Did you laugh?
Sometimes I laughed. I laughed not as much as I would have liked to.
Really?
And I didn't. I mean, I didn't think hummus. I mean, that's pretty. That's
infantile.
Pretty sort of weak kind of Catskill stuff, I think. And but there are some of the thing about Sacha Baron Cohen. He's an amazingly good physical and verbal comedian, and the whole like his whole German, his fake German and fake German English, and these weird compound words that he makes up are quite hilarious. And his ability to stay in character under duress. For example, when he's being, you know, beaten with a belt by a naked woman, and he doesn't, you know, fall apart. He stays Bruno. That's, you know, that's quite a feat. I certainly couldn't do that.
And Clooney couldn't do that, probably. George Clooney.
No, Sean Penn maybe.
Finally, it seemed like it took more to draw the homophobia out of the situations, whereas in the anti-Semitic stuff of Borat, it was much easier. People sort of volunteered their anti-Semitism much more than they volunteered their homophobia in this movie, and that's one of the problems with it, I think.
I think that's one of the problems is you have to go, and in fact, you know, even there's a famous sequence where he tries to kind of trick Ron Paul, former presidential candidate and congressman, into being in a sex tape with him, and at
the
end,
love the premise.
Yeah, no, the premise is great, but the thing is, when you watch it, you can say, well, at the end, of course, you know, Ron Paul exposes what maybe you could call homophobia, but it's more that, you know, he's in this hotel room and this guy is taking off his clothes and trying to have sex with him. And I don't think you necessarily have to be a homophobe to freak out of this. I mean, if Ron Paul was a woman and it was a straight man, you know, that wouldn't be it wouldn't be funny, and there wouldn't be a question of homophobia. So, yes, I think that he has to dig very deep and sometimes even force the issue a little bit. You know, that is if you're you know, out camping with some hunters and you take off all your clothes and try to get in their tent naked. It doesn't necessarily prove that they're hateful bigots if they object.
But just watch the hijinks, huh? Tony Scott, our friend and film critic for our partners, the New York Times. A.O. Scott is the byline. Check it out yourself. The movie Bruno opens today. Thanks so much, A.O. Scott and Marcus Garrison with the headlines, buddy.
You got it. 20 minutes before the hour news this hour that General Motors is now out of bankruptcy protection. The U.S. trade deficit is at its lowest level in nearly a decade, and L.A. investigators have subpoenaed Michael Jackson's medical records. Father Joe Jackson tells ABC he suspects, quote, foul play. Those are the headlines, John.
In 10 minutes, Anthony Fauci talks about H1N1. A lot of news. Stay tuned.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. We go now to Chicago to Lolly Boeen, who's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune, to talk about a gruesome story which broke this morning. It comes from the Chicago suburb of Alsip. 300 plots in a historic black cemetery were opened, the bodies dumped, and the cemetery plots themselves resold for a profit. Lolly Boeen, good morning.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
I mean, this is the strangest scam I've ever heard. Give us some details here. And we have actually some tape from Sheriff Tom Dart, the Cook County, Illinois sheriff, talking a little bit about this. But first of all, sketch out the story as you understand it.
Well, Sheriff Tom Dart called us to the cemetery on Wednesday evening to inform us that four former workers at the cemetery had been arrested. And essentially what they were doing was they were digging up old bodies, just dumping them in a back abandoned area and reselling the graves for a profit, for a cash profit. So when families came to bury their loved ones, they were being sold formerly used plots.
And this, of course, would be outrageous and shocking under any circumstances, but this cemetery itself has historical significance. Describe this particular cemetery.
Well, Burr Oak Cemetery, for many years, has been the resting place for African Americans. During a time of segregation, it was the only cemetery that allowed black people to bury their dead there. It's located in a suburb outside of Chicago, and 70 years ago, before cemeteries were open and available, African Americans took their families there, even though it was a long journey to get there from the city. As a result, it's the resting place of many historic African Americans, very prominent. Dinah Washington is buried there. Emmett Till's remains are there. Many Negro League players are there. And it's a longtime custom and tradition for African Americans that once one family member is buried in a cemetery, you bury the rest of them there so that all the bodies can be together.
Now,
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Describe the accused. Who are the accused here, and what's their status at this point?
The accused are four workers who worked for the cemetery. Carolyn Towns, Keith Nix, Terrence Nix, and Maurice Daly have been named by Sheriff Darden, all charged with dismembering human bodies. They have all been taken into custody. They were workers at the cemetery. Carolyn Towns was the office manager, and she is the person who's being accused of sort of masterminding it and overseeing this scam.
Now, in terms of the community, are these African-American employees? Are these white employees of the cemetery? Do we know any more about them?
These are indeed African-American employees of the cemetery, and that's another layer to the outrage that many of the residents felt, and much of the betrayal is that these are African Americans who understood and knew the importance of burial rituals and had a lot of trust placed in them. And so they've betrayed the community, they've betrayed these residents, and hurt a lot of people.
Any idea? We've got to go in the next couple of seconds. There will be a 10 a.m. news conference, and the sheriff's going to speak again. But how much money was involved here? Do we know?
The allegations are up to $300,000.
That is so...
Those were the last numbers that we were given.
So sad. Well, Lolly Boeing, reporter with the Chicago Tribune, you'll be at that news conference, right?
I will be there.
All right. Covering the story for us here at The Takeaway, Lolly Boeing, reporter with the Chicago Tribune, on a gruesome story of a cemetery plot scam in Alsip, outside of Chicago.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Time for our last check-in with Mark Garrison. Last check-in of the week with the headlines. Mark?
The Friday headlines at 12 minutes before the hour. President Obama is hailing progress made this week at the G8 summit in Italy, but he's also got ideas for future global meetings.
The one thing I will be looking forward to is fewer summit meetings, because, as you said, I've only been in office 6 months now, and there have been a lot of these.
President says he wants more streamlined summits. He visits the Pope in a little bit, then to West Africa to visit Ghana later today. General Motors is now out of bankruptcy. We just heard from GM CEO Fritz Henderson earlier this hour. And in sports, riders are now racing downhill near the finish of the first big mountain stage at the Tour de France. Lance Armstrong is not at the front of the pack. He beat start today in second place. Finally, NASA is
incredible.
In space, NASA is going to give the much delayed Endeavour launch another try tomorrow, weather permitting, of course. There are predicted thunderstorms, so we'll see about that.
Good
John?
Luck to NASA. Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. Welcoming back to the program now Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He was in attendance at an enormously significant, potentially significant, but very unusual H1N1 flu summit that was held yesterday at the National Institutes of Health. It included a video link up with President Obama live from Italy at that G8 summit. First of all, Dr. Anthony Fauci, good morning.
Good morning.
This was an unprecedented interagency gathering that involved the Secretary of Health and Human Services, also Homeland Security. You had the Secretary of Education there. And then, of course, all the people at the NIH involved with the public health issues. First of all, did it help to have all those cooks in the room?
Well, yes, in a sense, because what it also did is it brought together many, many officials from the state and local jurisdictions who are going to be the ones, after all, that will be implementing the flu pandemic preparedness plan that we have been working on now intensively over the last few months since the recognition of this new H1N1 virus in April, but also for the previous few years in preparation for the bird flu, which we've been watching for at least several years. So it was an important meeting because it brought together all of the parties who will be involved in the implementation of the plan. And as you mentioned, there were three secretaries plus John Brennan of the White House Homeland Security Council.
Now, what do you think the first issue is going to be? Where's the front line in this H1N1 battle? Is it the vaccine development? And I want to get an update from you on that. Or is it something to do with the schools? Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, of course, spoke a lot with reporters yesterday.
Well, it's both. The issue with the schools is how do we handle outbreaks that involve schools? And it's a delicate balance because the main line is that when children get sick, the parents are encouraged not to send the children to school. But sometimes when there's so much illness in the school and it can't function, that leads to the closing of the schools, which we saw just a short while ago, particularly in New York City, which it was an appropriate thing to do. And then when that lessened up a bit, the schools were reopened. But the point that you made earlier is the critical issue, and that is the preparation by getting a vaccine. We are already well into the process of the developing a vaccine, and what we discussed openly yesterday was the time frame. We're going to start clinical trials on an H1N1 vaccine probably in the first week in August. It'll take a couple of months to determine, is it safe? Does it induce the response you want it to induce? And what's the right dose to give? And the projection is that by mid-October, we'll have doses, if the decision is made to vaccinate individuals, that we will be able to start that, hopefully, in the middle of October.
Now, historically, though, the rhythm of how this infectious disease, this pandemic, would peak would be in the early fall, maybe not so much October, but more September. Is October going to be on the right time frame?
You know, not necessarily. If you look at seasonal flu, the flu vaccinations that we do like clockwork every year, we generally start the vaccinations the end of October, beginning of November, because the flu season in its regular seasonal rhythm usually peaks in midwinter, not in the early fall. We'd like to get it started as soon as we possibly can, but the standard rhythm of the flu is that it peaks sometime December, January, not September.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Homeland Security. Now, it sounds good, and perhaps it feels good to have Homeland Security in the room on something like this, but what are the tools at their disposal that would help someone like you who's involved in public health?
Sure. Well, that's an excellent question that got asked several times in the process. When you think about the health issues, the vaccine, the drugs, the public health issues, both nationally and in the local, state, city arena, clearly that's the Department of Health and Human Services. But if you get a pandemic that's disruptive of society, that involves multiple departments and multiple areas of our society, from transportation to school to the economy. In other words, anything that would be disruptive to what you'd be called the security of the nation when things start getting disconnected, that's where you get Homeland Security in there. So it's the overarching concern about a disaster, i.e. a hurricane, a flu, or what have you. But the medical aspects clearly are handled by the Department of Health and Human Services.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion this year since this swine flu, H1N1 flu, came out, that there's plenty of gauging of the severity of this pandemic on the question of how quickly the infections are propagating around the world. But there's very little gauging of this flu on the basis of how sick it can make you, how much of a threat it is. It's sort of medical morphology when it actually gets into your body. What discussion was there about how to responsibly warn people about the significance of this, to give it a sense of priorities that are reasonable as opposed to just hysteria?
Well, that again, another good point that you make. But we do know right now in general what the severity has been. We have experience in the United States, a lot of infection here in the United States, Mexico, and also now throughout the world. So fundamentally, with some exceptions of people who can get severely ill, particularly troublesome, some young people who are otherwise well, in general, you would characterize what we're seeing now as a mild to, at the worst, moderate severity pandemic. So we do know that it is not an overwhelmingly virulent virus at this time. The concern that we have and that we continually discuss is that influenza viruses can change. They can mutate.
Right.
So you have to watch it very carefully that it doesn't become more fierce or more virulent as it evolves in human. The good news is that we've been tracking this intensively since the beginning of April. And now in mid-July, it hasn't changed at all. It's virtually identical, the virus, molecularly and how it's working since it was in April.
Well, that's
so
great news.
That doesn't mean it's not going to change, but it's encouraging news that it's not a rapidly changing virus.
Absolutely. That's great news. It's a great takeaway. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Before we go, a couple more questions. Is the technology of this vaccine that they're developing standard issue technology? Are they trying something new because the stakes are really high here? We're not testing this out on the American people, are we?
No. This is standard technology, which we've been used for decades and decades. We want to get to more advanced technology, but the advanced technology is not ready for prime time now and will not be used in the development of the vaccine that we want to get to the American people by the fall. So this is standard, tried and true technology.
Any consensus at the H1N1 summit yesterday about what the triage is on virus, on who gets the vaccination first?
Yeah, that's a good point, a very important point. This virus is acting in an interesting way. Unlike other influenzas, it seems to preferentially infect young people the way it did so intensively and is doing in New York City. So the preferential prioritization will be that we'll go for school children first, and then individuals who are particularly vulnerable to severe disease, like pregnant women, adults who have underlying conditions, as well as healthcare workers, will be right there in the mix taking care of people. But young individuals of school age will be the high priority.
You know, I got to make a little news today. Barack Obama announced the nominee for your boss, Dr. Anthony Fauci, yesterday. Any comment on that?
Yeah, that's Francis Collins. He's a great scientist, a good person. He's been a good friend and a colleague for the last 15 years. He was the director of one of the institutes, the Genome Institute here. So we're all looking forward to his confirmation by the Senate.
All right, well, just helping the HR issues there at the NIH, welcoming Dr. Collins in, who has to face confirmation. Now, Dr. Anthony Fauci, thanks so much for being on the program again.
You're quite welcome. Good to be here.
Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, right there on The Takeaway. A lot of information there. More on our website, where you can find out about an H1N1 infection map. You can find out if the flu is anywhere near you at thetakeaway.org. That's where you can find that map. On our minds all day, we're investigating the state of the American mall in this economy. With retail sales down, what's going on?
Hi, this is Chris Dooley, White Lake, Michigan. I think the big malls are just about done because everywhere you look, there's a strip mall. Out by where I live in Michigan, they are putting a strip mall on every corner. People aren't shopping in the malls anymore. They're going closer to home.
The retail engine in the American economy is changing, and you're telling our stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend, everyone. If you see Bruno, you can write a review on our website, 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a good weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.